Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 136, being recorded on the 20th of July, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale and Evan. The old gang's back together. Evan, glad to have you back from your vacation. Hope all was well.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to be back with you guys. I'm a little torn. Vacation, still vacation, so, you know.
Yeah. Hopefully you remember all the Azure commands still after
what,
3 weeks.
What is that? This cloud thing? I don't know.
Yeah. And Kale, how are things over on the other side of the pond?
Yeah, no, everything's good over there. It was fun times. We finished up that stuff. We put a link in that thing a couple weeks ago about the edX stuff, and that was kind of the one of the final ones that we were doing to, you know, working with a learning partner over there to get architects trained on Azure. So everything went well, and lots of good food and things over there. So that was fun.
Awesome. Do you remember what your house looks like, Kale?
Yeah, no, and next week's Redmond. So it's like, oh, God, here we go again.
Wow. Putting on those another million mile year for you, huh?
Yeah.
All right. You know, it's good to have the gang back, and let's get our listeners caught up on some of the new updates in the Azure space. There are a few of them this week. Let's see, Evan, anyone you like? You put the list out there, so you get to pick.
Yeah, this just shows I'm pulling it up now because this just shows how out of it I was this week. I don't even remember putting stuff in, but I know I did now that you mention it.
Well, there's a SQL one in there.
I do remember. So a couple – the one thing that caught my attention, and I'm going to, you know, see if I can call in some favors, but, you know, SQL Server Stretch DB is GA now, right? And this is the ability to basically have part of your table on-premises on your SQL Server instance, and then the rest of it, you know, based on some criteria, sitting out in Azure, right? It's kind of the old partitioning mindset, but this is dynamically – you can do this dynamically, and it's built in the SQL Server 2016.
And I know that they kind of say you should put warm and cold transaction data, right? That's how they position that. So I guess what that means is that you shouldn't put hot data out in the Stretch DB, correct?
I think because again, I mean, there's pretty big latency when you go out to the to the web, right? But I think this is really, you know, I mean, coming from the SQL Server space, right? There's lots of people that have to you know, regulatory or whatever reason, keep their data around an incredible amount of time, but the percentage of time that they actually query against it is very small.
Right.
Right, and so they end up having these massive databases, and yeah, you can do partitioning and all that, but that still is, it can be non-trivial sometimes to manage that. Now it's just built in. You come up with your stretch definition, right, which data gets stretched out and which doesn't, and SQL Server handles it for you. Actually, just a precursor for the audience, I've got a colleague from the SQL Server space who is now one of the principal architects for SQL Server. He's willing to come on. We're going to figure out when we can get him scheduled, but willing to come on and talk about all the cool things that they can do in SQL Server, in SQL Server 2016, that could only be done because of Azure's existence.
Wow.
You know, that'll be a real fun.
That would be a nice discussion to have. Yeah.
Now, does this? I'm a little confused about how this actually works. Does that go like from on-prem to Azure, or can you do like Azure to Azure? And this is only IaaS, or?
You know, that's a good question. It is a base feature of SQL Server 2016, so you absolutely can do on-premises to Azure. I would assume, and it would be surprising if we put a hard block in, that there's really, you know, nothing says you can't. Oh, and this, by the way, this goes to SQL Azure, Azure Stretch side, right? So, but I would, there shouldn't be any reason that blocks you from doing it on an IaaS VM.
So this goes from, like, IaaS to the PaaS version?
It basically goes from SQL Server full, SQL Server 2016 full, and stretching the data to Azure SQL Database.
Right.
Okay.
IaaS running on premises, right?
Yeah.
That's what
I think what it,
ETL.
yeah, I think what Evan was saying is like how would it differentiate between IaaS running in Azure versus on premise?
Yeah, it won't know. I mean you can I mean SQL I strongly suspect this will work either way. Now if you're in Azure
it wouldn't make sense then, you know, then you just why use Stretch? You just I mean then space is not a constraint, right? That, I think the main issue is if you have it on premises, you may not have like terabytes of space.
Yeah.
And this way you can expand it in the cloud. Whereas if you're in the cloud already, you already have the terabyte at your kind of fingertips
right
there.
Yeah, I think that part of this is going to be around query performance, right? If I don't know how much you guys have played around with it, but the bigger your database gets in SQL, the more sensitive it is to making sure that you have good queries,
right?
So if you – and again, I haven't dug into this super, super deep, but I got to imagine that the optimizer now is smart enough to realize that, hey, you're only hitting local data. So we can do a much different query than if you're hitting local plus remote, right? Or trying to hit the massive table, right? If that was there. So yeah, you know, I would like to go play with this a little bit more. Again, I've got another somebody I know that's in the SQL Server Stretch DB space, and we're going to try and get them on here as well to talk in depth about this. But it's, I mean, this just to me the reason it jumped out at me again was just because this is one of these things that like you can't, a lot of things we do in Azure. We're making easier to do, or we're, you know, just kind of replicating what we did on premises, but it's, you know, maybe easier to deploy or whatever the case may be. But this is the kind of thing like you couldn't do this without the cloud services. I mean, you could do replication, but you're still, you know, you're still hitting a real disk, and you still have space constraints and all that kind of stuff. So,
and there's a related update to this one, Evan. So one of the use cases in this particular one is, let's suppose you have really sensitive data, maybe credit card information, right? And that's and now you're talking of stretched, right? I mean, it was all fine. You had it on premises and you were happy with it. Now, when you go stretched, there's a chance that some of that information winds up in a stretched database in Azure. And then, you know, someone would probably from security will say, oh, wait a minute, that's all credit card information, right? I mean, we just don't want to put it up in the cloud. And so there's this another feature that got released as generally available, and that's called Always Encrypted. Okay, and that's another feature of SQL Server Azure that kind of became active along with this. And that what that does is it lets you encrypt the stuff at source, in other words, at the client side.
Yep.
Where the application is running, such that the information in SQL Azure is always encrypted, so that even if you had some sort of a rogue system administrator that had access to the database, they couldn't go in and see that information. It would be encrypted.
Right. It's really analogous to what we used to call the TDE, transparent data encryption. Not exactly alike, but similar concept, right? Which is your data is always encrypted at rest. It's always encrypted on the back end.
Right. And I think in this particular case, they have specific columns that you mark as,
yes.
I think you go through the, whatever, the management studio and you kind of do it from there. But you can query those encrypted columns. That's the beauty of it, right? It's not like
exactly.
You're not dealing with encrypted values in the query. You're dealing with real values in the query. But in fact, they're encrypted on when they're stored in SQL Azure. So
yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, and that's the reverse, right? Typically, right, you have to like have all this special code to deal with encrypting and decrypting your data as you go, because you're storing kind of this, you're kind of manually encrypting and storing it.
Right,
right. This allows you to do it all kind of as part of the service.
Yep.
So, yeah, no, I agree. That's a really cool, and you can absolutely combine them, so.
Great. Okay, so another one, I guess, I can't believe we added two new Azure regions in the U.S., really growing fast there. So West U.S. 2 and West Central U.S., two more regions, brings it a total of 26 generally available, which is apparently more than any other major cloud vendor, so yay. And I guess they may not have all the services up and running on them yet, but you know, over time, I'm sure all of them will be available in these two new regions.
Yep.
What else we got? Let's see.
I wonder about that one. I haven't seen that pricing, but I'm wondering if that's part of the reason for those. I don't know if you guys know or not, but is that obviously capacity is a good thing, but is it also because we're putting them in a slightly different location to get the price down, or?
I mean, I'm sure that's always part of as we do this stuff and figure out where to put it. You know, you put it somewhere where power's cheap and land's cheap, and you know, and you have ready access to the utilities. But I'm not sure something specific driving these. At least not that I've heard publicly.
Oh, so what you're saying is that a U.S. East location might cost more, and therefore the price may be more. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, depending on where you position data centers, like if you position something in Silicon Valley versus, you know, other places that aren't like
Idaho
like that,
or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Evan said, the power is different, everything else is different. But I don't know if that's part of the motivation there.
Good question.
Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. Some of it, you know, I'm sure some of it is just like you said, you know, we keep chewing up servers, right? I mean, it's incredible the amount of growth. What was it? We just announced in our earnings yesterday another, you know, another quarter of 100%+ growth.
Well, that's amazing. 100% over a quarter. How the hell do you do that?
And this has been quarter after quarter after quarter, Sajid. Yeah. So
incredible. Good for the company. Yeah. Really happy for them. Let's see. Azure Express Route and now available in most cities near you.
Yep.
Quebec City, Paris, and Newport, Wales. So that's good. It looks like a lot of stuff in Europe there.
Yep.
And so how does that help? That means that if you're a customer, there's probably a circuit near you. Is that what the whole idea is?
Yeah, well, this is all about the peering locations, right? Mm-hmm. So places where customers can peer with us, Microsoft, and then we handle the connection from there to our data centers. But the more peering locations, the more likely that a customer is able to get into our infrastructure with less kind of, you know, external, less distance to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's always going to speed up traffic.
Right, right. Physical distance is always important.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And then I guess just to round it off, I guess the Power BI now is generally available with the standard SLA in some of the data centers. So I guess just expanding the offerings. One thing I thought was interesting in the way that they price Power BI embedded, and I wasn't aware of this, is I think today it's priced per view, right? So if you pull up a graph in Power BI, I guess that particular view is you're charged for every view of that graph, and now they're I think they're going to change it to a more like a session-based pricing model instead of a view-based. So, it'd be interesting to see. I didn't realize that whole pricing system was so convoluted.
That's kind of interesting. This is kind of, I don't know if you guys ever dealt with it, but back when I used to support reporting services, we had the report viewer control where you could kind of embed it in your app and you didn't have to have the back end. This is really analogous to this. Is now you can kind of, I mean, Power BI makes really nice graphics.
Right.
I mean, really nice looking charts. And now you can just kind of embed this in your app without having to have a full Power BI deployment, you know, or jumping out of your app somewhere else. I mean, this is just kind of local to your code. So, definitely cool.
Sorry, without I know we didn't have this in the link dump, but we can't not talk about blockchain. So we had the hard fork actually happened today for Ethereum, which was pretty cool. This is it's not cool, but it had to be done, which was basically I think we mentioned this on a show before. There was a company called the DAO who created something that had an exploit in the language, right, that allowed some attacker to change something and basically siphoned off $60 million.
Saw that, yeah.
So the idea was, okay, what do you do now? Like, so do we just say we learned a hard lesson and, you know, eat that $60 million and say we'll make sure that our language is better going forward and this kind of thing? Or do you hard fork, which is what they call it, where basically you rewrite history? So if you can think about a chain running along and all the transactions are going, and then at some point you say, okay, we're going to change it, so there's a parallel universe, basically. So now you would say, okay, we'll incentivize people to go to the hard fork, which basically allows them to recover their funds from those exploited things, and then the other fork just keeps going and eventually dies. It depends, you know, do people want the old or the new? And so it was kind of interesting, kind of social thing. Yeah.
I'm having a hard time just understanding that concept. Yeah, saying there's two accounting systems running, I guess.
Yeah, it was kind of confusing at first to me because I was like, wait a second, does that mean like if somebody had, let's say, 1,000 ether in one chain and when it splits, now they have two with the same amount? And like, yeah.
Stock split, but better.
I'm like, that's awesome. So you just like double money, but it doesn't work that way. But no, the idea was, that whatever the community decided, which was really cool. So they didn't come down to saying, hey, we're going to do this. They said, what do people want to do?
Yeah.
And you could just choose your faith. And it wasn't a vote. It was like, I'm going hard fork or I'm not. And then you could watch it today. It's kind of cool to see how this works. You just watch the telemetry and you could see. So blockchains basically scale the difficulty based on the load that's in the system automatically. So if difficulty starts going down, that means nobody's using it or something's wrong. If difficulty's going up, it means there's a lot of traffic and a lot of people are in it. And you could watch as soon as the hard fork happened, you could see the other one difficulty start going down, 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 and it was like 30% at the end of the day. It was like, okay, I guess that worked. It was a hard fork, so.
So does that mean then the whole 60 million is just kind of now being recovered? Is that what eventually happens?
Yeah. I mean, the people that chose hard fork could go recover their funds, and everybody's happy. I the purists of the world probably are not happy, because you essentially rewrote history, which you're not supposed to do.
Right.
But
Hopefully they won't
that's
do
what
it again.
the community decided, though. It wasn't Sam Foundation.
I think that's an. I mean, that's probably the thing about this that strikes me as the most interesting is it wasn't, the community weighed in on what they wanted to do, and then it sounds like because you can do either one, right? You're not being forced to do one or the other. And not only can the community debate which way they want the overall effort to go, but each individual can decide which one they want to do. Which, man, that's totally different than. Some of the other mechanisms where some corporate entity says, "Hey, we're doing X, and you're gonna like it." Right? So it's kind of neat.
I need to buy some ether, right? Is that what it's called?
You definitely should to do.
Just for the just
Yeah, the education. Yeah.
No, just I have some skin in the game there, Cool. Okay, so well, you're talking about all these distributed computing platforms like the blockchains and stuff like that, and we have this SIggraph coming up, SIggraph 2016, which is one of the kind of premier events for computer vision and graphics. Very high compute scenarios. I guess we figured we hadn't really talked about. High performance computing in Azure, and because that is definitely one of the use cases, it's not called out specifically in the Azure website, which is something that was addressing. But if you look for HPC, you will find that once you get into the compute area of the IaaS area, there is a specific set of VMs that are set up for. HPC clustering and high performance compute. And in fact, I think Kale, you've been close to one of them, right? The N series VMs. What's been happening in that world over there?
No, that yeah. To take a step back, the N series is the GPU that's still coming. It's been announced. I think it was announced actually last year that we were doing this, but there's been some delays in hardware and such. But the thing is, it's a feature of 2016 server. So 2016. I don't. When does that go live? I'm not sure if we have a date yet on it. When that goes live, that actually has, if you have like TP5, I think it was post TP4, there's a feature in there now basically that allows us to disconnect or give a PCI Express slot to a guest directly. So, on premises, if you had a machine and let's say we had huge graphics cards plugged into them, you could basically say this PCI slot that contains this GPU is now going to be given to this guest exclusively. And there's very little overhead there. There's like no Microsoft driver or any of that kind of stuff in between. So on the guest, you would install, let's say it's an NVIDIA GPU, you would install their driver, and so the performance is awesome, super fast. And you can imagine that we can do the same thing in Azure,
Now, are you saying that the GPU is installed in the PCI slot? Is that what you said?
Yeah, and a PCI Express slot.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so that lets you do the compute within the node itself at a very high rate, correct? Because it's
That's
going to
correct.
use the GPU. But well, one of these kind of scenarios that they talk about when it comes to HPC is that you have a cluster of machines, right? Because they're typically tackling problems that are too difficult to solve in one node, let's say. And they require to be broken down into like a number of small chunks, the algorithm that you're trying to solve, maybe a graphics algorithm or a scientific algorithm. You know, this whole thing, I remember way back in the SETI is something that comes to mind, search for extraterrestrial program, where they're basically, you know, analyzing a bunch of, I guess, you know, star picture.
Gotta admit,
waves,
used to run it. So,
I used to run it too, yeah. So, so my CPU was always at like 50% doing I don't know what. But,
you should have been mining Bitcoin. I don't know what you were doing.
I should have gotten early on that one. So one of the, I guess one of the unique things that these things have to do is all these programs that are running on these nodes are constantly talking to each other, right? It's this very elaborate cluster of nodes that has to communicate with each other, and so that's one of the unique things, right, with this whole with these whole type of what do they call them, A10 and A11, I think, are the specific
RDMA. The RDMA stuff.
RDMA stuff, exactly. Yeah, the remote direct memory access. And what? So, is there something that you, Kale, is there something that you can share on that, on the RDMA stuff?
No, I mean, that stuff's been around for a while, that technology. Like we've had that, you said, like in the A series even, which basically allows you to kind of skip some of the, you know, TCP/IP type stuff, the whole stack there, whenever you're communicating between, so it's faster. But the thing is, we do have that even on the N series, so the clear high-end SKU of that, you'll be able to build clusters and use RDMA with that as well.
Okay. And I remember way back, sorry, go ahead.
Evan, I don't know, that's something like, or Sajid, I think it's like 40 gig a second, is that, am I remembering that right?
Some ridiculously large number. I can't, yeah. I'd have to go dig up what the exact number is, but it's massive.
Yeah, it's a 32 GB backend RDMA capable, that's what it says, at least the A8 and A9.
Okay.
So you're pretty close there. But one of the things that I believe why this is required is all these programs that are running in these HPCs, they use something called MPI, right? The message passing interface or something like that, which is a way for all these nodes to communicate with each other. And that's what makes all this very complex compute possible, in the fact that, you know, different nodes are calculating different pieces of the puzzle, and then eventually they're all sharing information, and then that gets somehow rolled up into something that is usable by the end user. So, just trying to think of like some of the scenarios where this may be used. What are you seeing that, especially with the N series, like what are some of the typical use cases for using some of these big compute VMs? What?
I mean, you can, especially with the N series, I mean, you can certainly see, you know, rendering, like visual graphics rendering. You can, I used to do CFD or computational fluid dynamics in days past. I mean, that would certainly fit really well in this situation. That's kind of what the N series stuff opens up, is some of the GPU stuff. I mean, I think even without the N series, right, there's still some really neat HPC capabilities, or, you know, high performance cluster clustering capabilities of Azure. I mean, think about it. You can, you know, we were talking about StretchDB for SQL. Well, you can also do Windows HPC Stretch. And I forget if that's the exact term for it, but basically you can have some of your, you can have your head node and some of your nodes on premises, and you can extend that cluster into Azure. It, you know, so basically it's on demand resources, right, if you want them. Right, because that's always been the problem that I've, you know, when I've dealt with customers that are dealing with this, the problem they always run into is they got, you know, hundreds, tens or hundreds of machines just sitting there doing nothing in the on-premises world until they need them. Right? In Azure, you know, great, maybe you have your small cluster on-premises for most of your jobs, and then once a quarter, once a month, you make this really big cluster because you got to do these massive things, you know, once a quarter. Well, now you can just, that other stuff can, you can flex as you need to.
Yeah, I think the other neat thing that we kind of have with the N series that kind of enables is one thing when you start doing that is like, okay, well, even if it's not the N series, like you said, Evan, it's just batch or one of our other HPC things in Azure. Still, the problem is like you got to get data there. So then that becomes an issue, right? It's like, okay, yep. So we got all this data. So if you think about like maybe like a game studio or a movie studio who's going to do like light mapping and rendering and this kind of stuff, it's like massive amounts of data. Mm-hmm. And so like, great, now we got GPUs so we can speed that up. You know, maybe it goes faster now, but then we have to get the data there. So the interesting thing is we have like the K80s and the M60s. The M60s are more tailored towards the kind of RDP type stuff. So basically, someone could basically be running a VM that has their rendering workstation in Azure. So the data's there now. And then you can take advantage of all the other stuff that's up there to do all this really fast processing. So in that case, there's lower footprint on the desktop of that guy who's using that CAD software or that rendering type stuff.
Yep. Yeah, and Kale, you know, we were talking about this just before the show. So there is also this other, I don't know if it's a standard or a software. It's called PCOIP workstation. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Made by Tara Dici. And that does exactly what you were just saying, which is it allows the user who could be sitting in some office somewhere, right? They have a workstation, which is just a run-of-the-mill machine, but it's, you know, they're doing all this fancy fluid dynamics or making a movie of some sort, rendering a movie. And that workstation software is essentially a remote view into what's happening in the software that's running in the HPC cluster in the cloud. So, you know, you got all these terabytes of data that is being processed in the cloud. It's being processed by maybe 100 nodes or whatever. And you've got this one workstation that is basically, that's your view, that's your software that you're using to look at all the results that are coming in from all that processing that's happening in the cloud. And one of the advantages of that is that the data is already in the cloud. You don't have to bring it down, because in the past, that was always an issue, right? You have all these gigabytes or terabytes of data, and once you finish processing it, you had to bring it down. Now you don't have to. You're just looking at it remotely, and Tara Dici's PCOIP workstation remote access software lets you do that by just, you know, giving you an app right on your machine as if you're doing the work locally, but in fact it's happening remotely. So that's something that I believe they're going to talk about when they go to SIGGRAPH. So that's something to look forward to there. What else? What other use cases do you guys think might be, or have you heard of, Evan, anything that's come across your desk in the support area?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen the classic on-prem Windows, you know, on-premises HPC stuff. I know the one thing that you can do, right, this is not just a Windows thing, this is not just an HPC thing, right, you can leverage, you know, Linux VMs in Azure doing the same thing. You know, so that really opens up, and there's, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I had as much experience with the Linux clustering type scenarios, but I mean that certainly opens up capabilities in there as well, because, you know, some of the things we're talking about are not Windows, they're not Linux, they're not necessarily Windows, they could be Linux as well. But I mean, as far as use cases, I mean, it really is anything that needs to be able to flex and scale and break these pieces out, right? Mm-hmm. I've not played much on that side, but you know, I know every time I turn around, somebody's trying to figure out how they get lots of machines to do this work.
Right.
I think the biggest one I saw before we had the GPU thing was V-Ray, which is like a ray tracing thing, again, for like rendering. Mm-hmm. People were using Azure Batch for that. So that was like a common workload that we would run in there. So you could run like,
this is like 100... visualization and kind of to do imaging stuff, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but that's but that's batch, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so there's two main use cases. One is interactive, which is the using a workstation, and then batch is something that I guess would just run over time and you get the results later kind of thing.
But similar problem, right? We need like 100 VMs really quickly.
Yes.
And yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just saying, like, if you're doing like an AutoCAD, you're kind of expecting results on the workstation immediately, right? As you're doing it, but each one of those strokes that you make could result in, a lot of computation to give you the results back.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think with, and this is kind of getting into forward thinking, which I totally and truly have no inside information here. Now that we've got the GPU stuff, which allows us to do the graphics pieces as well, I hadn't even thought about, we're talking about the AutoCAD type scenarios, but man, there's a whole industry around that has been blocked from doing stuff in the cloud because they don't have these high-end graphics GPUs. And man, you deal 3D modeling, you talk about these automotive companies and the aerospace companies, right? They do these massive models. They must have, I'm assuming they have large, very large clusters for these things. Now they're going to be able to push some of that out to Azure. I hadn't even like that just I know we've been talking about this, but I hadn't made that flip back to my old life. That now this is going to be a possibility. I'd be really interested to see what happens in a year out here as those folks get a chance to play with this capability and come up with new and neat things.
Yeah. Now, there are some couple of gotchas in case folks are going to try and do this themselves. Let's say they want to set up an HPC cluster, and in one of these A8, A9 VMs, for example. So one of the recommendations is that you don't use, like you don't use the free account, right? The Azure free account has a
Yeah, don't
very
do that.
limited. I know it probably sounds obvious, but it's a very limited set of cores that you get with that, and you'll blow through that in a few seconds or minutes if you try it. So your quota will go away very quickly. So yeah, use a pay-as-you-go account, and apparently there's also a quota on cores, right? Per there's
Yep.
20
There
cores
is.
per
Yeah, 20
subscription.
cores by default. Yeah.
And so I guess they have to call, open up a support ticket if they want to increase that. And I'm guessing 20 cores might be nothing for somebody, some of these workloads. So they get something to kind of think about over there.
I think the other interesting workload here I saw like a while back was the deep learning stuff is becoming big with imaging. So like a Facebook's and Twitter's and even us and Microsoft using that to do image recognition. So we have a toolkit called CNTK, which is basically like a
CNTK, is that what you said?
yeah. It's I think MSR has built this,
Okay.
but it's becoming more kind of a real product, and it basically does like neural networks and can do this deep learning type thing. I would say they're probably something that's like a counterpart would be something like TensorFlow from Google, which does something very similar. The interesting thing was CNTK, one of the cool things about it is it does really well with multiple GPUs. So to this point, when people were building deep learning stuff, there was kind of this bottleneck where it was like you could have massive, in a single machine, have like a big GPU or even like an SLI bridge to like a card there, but there was no way to kind of span machines. It wasn't something that was built in. I think CNTK does that really well. So it'll be interesting to see how that works once we get these multiple machines, like maybe the N series, and using CNTK to see how that'll scale.
Okay. One of the things that, we're all developers here, and always think about, how I could develop software for say an HPC or one of these kind of cluster machines. And let me tell you cannot use .NET in most cases in these things. It's all like Fortran or C,
Oh, Fortran. I hadn't thought about Fortran in years.
So it's kind of amazing that, that those are the APIs that are available to you. So if all you know is .NET, then you're kind of out of luck there. But yeah, it's this is very very much used by the scientific community. There's a lot of the universities use it, right? This is another big use case. When I was researching this topic, I noticed almost every university seems to have this kind of access using this.
Yeah, and by the way, while we were talking, I just you know, I on a whim, I thought I'd go see if TensorFlow runs on Azure, and it does.
Nice.
Somebody did figure out that you know using Docker, right? So it's just on top of the containers.
But, right, right.
You know,
that's
it
cool.
Absolutely does work in Azure. So.
Okay, I'll put that link in the show notes. Thanks, Evan. Okay, good. So I guess that's important. I'm glad we covered that. You know, it's something that we haven't really talked about before. I think it's not one of the most heavily used features of Azure, but I think definitely one that rounds off all the other offerings that we have. And it's good that we were able to cover it. Anything more you guys want to add, Cale? Anything? So you said the N series is not yet available, right? It's coming soon?
Yep.
Okay. Let's hope they figure out those hardware issues or whatever they're having, the supply issues. All right, guys, then that's it for today, and we'll catch up again next week. Thanks again for everything.
Sounds great. Cool.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.